Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Naomi Klein is an award-winning journalist, columnist, and author of the New York Times bestseller, This Changes Everything. The New Yorker described Naomi Klein as the most influential figure on the American left and the intellectual godmother of the Green New Deal. A proposed U.S. legislation that aims to address climate change and economic inequality, the Green New Deal combines FDR's economic approach with modern ideas such as renewable energy and resource efficiency. For more than 10 years, Naomi Klein has documented the movement of the climate crisis from future threat to burning emergency. Her latest book is On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal, and it's a collection of her essays. Naomi Klein is speaking on the Chico State University campus this Saturday, September 28th, in Harlem Adams Theater. Naomi Klein, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to coming to Chico.
Well, before I ask you to present your case, I need to ask you, what is the Green New Deal for people who may not have heard about this?
Absolutely. So the Green New Deal is a vision for the next economy, and it has come up from the grassroots of the environmental justice movement over many years. It's really about marrying the urgent need to transform our economy to get off fossil fuels and get to 100% renewable energy in line with what scientists are telling us, and they're telling us we have to do it in a big hurry. We need to really get it done, for electricity and transportation in a little bit more than a decade. The whole world needs to cut global emissions in half in the next 11 years. And in countries like the United States that have been polluting for a lot longer than other countries, we have to do it a lot faster. So the idea is that as we transform our economy to get it cleaner, we have a once-in-a-century opportunity to make it fairer on many different fronts. It's no secret that we live in a time of ever-widening economic inequality, of systemic economic exclusion along lines of race, along lines of gender. So if we are changing everything, as the scientists are telling us we need to do, why don't we multitask? Why don't we wage a war on poverty and inequality at the same time? And so there are various versions of what a Green New Deal would look like. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey, put out a resolution a few months ago that put in a few I think of it as a kind of a first rough draft of what a Green New Deal would have to include in terms of targets and principles of justice. And now we have many of the presidential candidates or people vying to be the Democratic candidate for president putting forward much more detailed Green New Deal plans. So there isn't one New Deal now. There's many different versions of it. It's going to be up to voters to decide which one is most ambitious and could really get the job done.
My guest is Naomi Klein, and she has a new book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. And your book is really up to date. I was so impressed that you got this book out so quickly. How did you do that?
Publishing is getting a little bit faster. but the truth is, I've been writing about these issues for a decade. It's breaking into the mainstream, finally. But the groundwork had been laid by a lot of folks. So I guess I was able to get it out really quickly because I've been sort of covering it for a long time.
Well, we have somebody on our staff here at North State Public Radio who's working on a project related to your book, and his name is Matt Fidler, and he has a project that is coming up really soon. It's going to be airing starting September 30th, so I would like to bring Matt into the conversation. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Nancy. Yeah, thanks. Naomi, I'm wondering, a lot about what the research for California Burning is about, ecosystem dysfunction. And I'm wondering, is there anything in the Green New Deal that encourages, the return of healthy ecosystem function to help mitigate, greenhouse gases like carbon and water vapor?
Right. So absolutely. But as you know, is the case with so much, we need more detail, and different candidates have put forward different plans. But I think what's really significant is that the Green New Deal is a response in part to this really harrowing report that came out almost exactly a year ago from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which brings together the world's leading climate scientists to tell governments where we are at when it comes to climate disruption, what our carbon budget is, what needs to be done if we're going to keep temperatures below certain levels, and it's based on very sophisticated modeling. So this report came out in October that said that if we want to keep warming below increased temperatures of 1.5 degrees Celsius, we've warmed the planet by 1 degree Celsius, and we are seeing impacts like the wildfires that you are on the front lines of. Obviously, there are multiple drivers of it, but one of them is just increased temperatures and dryness, increasingly intense storms. I'm not going to list all the climate impacts that we're already seeing. You know, we're already seeing them. So what scientists have told us is that if we want to preserve as much of a habitable planet as we can, we have to keep warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius. And in order to do that, we have to have emissions in the next 11 years. But they also said that so much carbon has already accumulated in the atmosphere that if we really want to do this, we have to draw down a whole lot of carbon. And the best way to do that, and the safest way to do that, is through ecosystem restoration, right? It's through reforestation, it's through wetlands restoration. One of the interesting things as we sort of remember the original New Deal, because, of course, this is named after FDR's original New Deal, is that the United States in the 1930s was not only facing an economic crisis, the worst economic crisis in American history, the Great Depression, but also the worst ecological crisis, the Dust Bowl. So some of the signature New Deal policies were tackling land erosion, soil erosion, and a deforestation crisis in the United States. So the Civilian Conservation Corps and several of the candidates have said that they want to bring back the Civilian Conservation Corps. Under FDR, the Civilian Conservation Corps did all kinds of land restoration and planted a staggering 2.3 billion trees in just, I believe, 9 years. And that's half the number of trees that have ever been planted in the United States. So I think we need to have a lot more discussion about what this would mean locally. And I don't think anybody should wait for politicians in Washington to tell them how this should be done. We need local knowledge, including indigenous knowledge, to lead this process.
My guest is Naomi Klein, and she has a brand new book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. And I've also asked Matt Fidler if he had questions for my guest, and he has a blog coming up, podcast called California Burning, that's going to be start airing September 30th. Now, Naomi, I want to bring up something that, do you find that people react emotionally to a mention of the Marshall Plan to combat climate change?
Emotionally? People aren't talking that much about a Marshall Plan. That tends to be talked about internationally. You know, in the book, I quote a Bolivian climate change negotiator named Angelica Navarro, who 10 years ago was talking about the need for a Marshall Plan for planet Earth, which is kind of like a green New Deal for the whole world. And I think it makes sense that is the historical analogy that people reach for outside the United States, because the Marshall Plan was very successful and ambitious plan for rebuilding in post-war Europe and also Japan. But look, I think people respond emotionally to any talk around the climate crisis, as well we should. This is an intensely emotional subject, and I think sometimes we make a mistake of sort of getting caught up so much of targets and the parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere, and all of that's really important, but we can forget that we're talking about our home, we're talking about our future, our kids' futures, and And we should make room for fear and grief, because I think if we don't, then we're going to sort of burn people out because they'll be repressing a lot of really powerful emotions that are absolutely natural to feel in the face of this kind of existential anxiety.
Well, you used adjective just now that I was thinking of, an adjective, hopeless. And what gives you hope, Naomi?
You know, what gives me hope is I am so energized by this new wave of climate justice activism that is overwhelmingly being led by young people, like the young climate strikers, who are inspired by Greta Thunberg, who I recently had the wonderful privilege of meeting and interviewing in New York City. And the climate strikes that are happening every Friday, and the Sunrise Movement, a movement led by young people across the United States who have put the Green New Deal on the political agenda and completely changed the debate. When I chose the name for my book, the fire, the on fire, it does refer to the literal fires that your communities have been on the front lines of. And so of mine, you know, my family lives on the west coast of Canada, British Columbia, and, you know, summer is now a season of smoke, and I write about that in the book. But the other fires I'm talking about are the fires of this growing movement, and young people are literally on fire with their determination to lead where their elders have failed and let them down.
My guest is Naomi Klein, and she will be speaking on the Chico State University campus this Saturday, September 28th, in Harlan Adams Theater. Now, you give a capsule case for a Green New Deal, and what are the suggestions that you have for us, Naomi?
Well, you know, at the end of the book, I just try to give people a little toolkit to win an argument with a skeptical family member or friend who says, you know, it's too expensive. So I lay out where we can get the money for this transformation. And also, you know, one of the things that I think is really important for people to remember is that one of the reasons why we have failed to introduce the kind of robust climate policies, even in a state like California, that we need is because people have come to associate climate action, climate policies with, increases in their cost of living. They see, you know, they're worried that their electricity bills will go up, that they'll have to pay more for everything. The truth is that this is a jobs program. And by including policies like Medicare for All in it, a jobs guarantee, it's really about breaking this idea that we have to choose between jobs and the environment. Or, you know, in France, the Yellow Vest movement says, when their president introduced a carbon tax, they said, you care about the end of the world and we care about the end of the month. And, you know, the Green New Deal is really about saying everybody has a right to care about the end of the world and the end of the month. And we have to design policies that respect both. The other thing is that a Green New Deal is really recession-proof. A lot of the reason why we have lost valuable time in the fight to have meaningful climate legislation is that, you know, when times are relatively good economically, there's generally a little bit of an appetite to have these policies that may increase cost of living. But as soon as there's an economic downturn, then immediately climate just gets like blown off the agenda. And that's what happened in 2009 in this country. I think the real strength of a Green New Deal style approach, and this is the argument I make at the end of the book, is that, you know, it's very possible that in the next couple of years we will enter another recession. And if that happens, then it will be a very good thing that we have a framework that is modeled after the greatest economic stimulus of all time, which is the original New Deal, which was designed as a way to battle the Great Depression. So there's just a few of the arguments that I think can be helpful in winning those arguments.
Well, of course, during the Great Depression, so many people did not have jobs at all or low-paying ones. And your first, number one, you say it will be a massive job creator. I think people would be very surprised to hear that. A massive job creator.
Well, look, I mean, we're talking about changing how we move ourselves around, where we get our energy, the kinds of buildings we live in. I mean, this is the biggest infrastructure project you could possibly imagine. So, of course, it's going to create huge numbers of jobs. And we already know that investments in renewable energy, energy efficiency, and public transit create more jobs than if you spend those dollars in oil and gas and coal. The real issue is that we need to make sure that those jobs are good jobs, that they're union jobs, that workers, get comparable salary levels and benefit levels that they get in the carbon sectors, in the high carbon sectors. And I don't think we've placed enough emphasis on that. The truth is that there are some very precarious renewable energy jobs, low-paying renewable energy jobs. Elon Musk, has been, a very aggressive union buster in his Tesla factory in California. It's not enough to just say, oh, there are going to be green jobs to replace the oil and gas jobs. We need to make sure they're good jobs.
My guest is Naomi Klein, and she has a new book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. She's been telling us what the problems are, what the Green New Deal is, and what we can do about it.
You know what? We're going to have to continue this discussion when I'm there in person.
Well, I'll remind people that they can get tickets to hear you speak and that you will be in Harlan Adams Auditorium on the Chico State University campus this Saturday, September 28th. Do you have anything else you'd like people to know before you come to see us, Naomi?
Well, just that I'm really looking forward to meeting folks and learning about what your communities have been going through. You're really on the front lines. And I think there's been so much courage and solidarity that's been shown in these incredibly trying times.
Well, thank you so much. We will look forward to seeing you here in Chico very soon. Thanks, Naomi.
Thank you so much. Take care. Looking forward to it. Bye-bye.
I'd also like to thank the producer of Nancy's Bookshelf, Matt Fidler, who has his podcast coming up, and this will be airing starting September 30th for the week. So, Matt, anything else you want to say about your podcast?
Yeah, no, it's going to be aired right here on North State Public Radio starting September 30th at 7 p.m. Monday through Friday. So all the way through, October 3rd, that is. So yeah, please listen, or you can get any of it, download all of it starting September 30th at californiaburning.net.
So that's the title, California Burning. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Nancy.
My guest is journalist Naomi Klein, and we're going to be taking a break now. And when I come back, I'll be talking to medical doctor Patch Adams. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. And I'm back with my guest, medical doctor and clown Patch Adams, who wrote a book, Gesundheit, saying that laughter and creativity are an integral part of healing. Dr. Patch Adams is best known for his work as a medical doctor and a clown, but he's also a social activist who has devoted over 40 years of his life to changing America's healthcare system. To him, fun is serious, and humor is an antidote to all ills. The title of his best-selling book is Gesundheit, Bringing Good Health to You, the Medical System, and Society Through Physician Services, Complementary Therapies, Humor, and Joy. Comic actor Robin Williams portrayed Patch Adams in a 1998 movie, but how accurate was his portrayal? Patch Adams, welcome.
Thank you. And I want to correct, I'm in the 49th year of this project.
Yeah. Okay. Well, people know you through the movie that they saw Robin Williams in. And so I think that's probably what I should ask you first is what people know about you through the movie. How accurate is that?
Well, can I say what I'm really about?
Well,
When I entered medical school in 1967, I saw nothing good about our medical system. And so I spent my medical school years designing a hospital that I thought was right. And I started it in 1971. No one gave me a hospital, so 20 adults, three of us doctors, moved into a large six-bedroom house and said we were a hospital. We had 500 to 1,000 people in our home each month with 5 to 50 overnight guests a night. And we did this for 12 years. And then I realized, since not a single donation came in that time, that it was more important that we had refused publicity before then, was what sells in this country is fame. And so we went public and had to close our doors. And I have been lecturing and performing. I'm a 6.5 million miler, frequent flyer miler. I've lectured and performed in 82 countries. And the Hollywood bought my first book, Gesundheit, saying that they would make a movie and build our hospital. I want to say up front that the movie was hugely successful, and they didn't give me a penny. In fact, they shot me in the foot at the end of the film by saying that I'm funded. So the movie is simple. Two things sell in movies, violence and humor. So much more interested in the one murder that happened, although they did change it from a man to a woman, a little humiliating to his family. And, you know, I am about funny. I've clowned in 82 countries. But what I'm about is, in this country, the U.S., your medical bill is the number one reason you lose your home and 70% of bankruptcies. And we're building a hospital that eliminates 90% of the cost, where all the permanent staff live together as a communal eco-village, and everyone from the cleaning people to the surgeon people make the same salary, $300 a month. And it'll be, to my knowledge, there are no funny, loving hospitals, and so we'll be the first one.
Well, one difference, obviously, to people who know that you are 6'4", 6 feet 4 inches, Robin Williams is a good bit shorter, so there's a difference right there. And of course, as you say, they have to make a movie that appeals to the public. Now, when you were growing up, at a point when you had been a very serious student and you saw a movie, Zorba the Greek, and in your book, you say, I saw a very significant movie about that time, Zorba the Greek. My dilemma was the same as that of the English bookworm in the story. You think too much, that's your trouble, Zorba told him. I stopped thinking that thinking mattered more than anything else and started putting feelings first. After 10 or 12 days in the hospital, now this, you've already explained that you were hospitalized because you had wanted to commit suicide.
I didn't want to live in a world of violence and injustice. I grew up overseas on military bases. My father was a soldier. He died as a soldier when I was 16, and we moved in 1961 to the South, which is where my mother's culture is. And my life changed forever in a public park at a public drinking fountain where the sign said, whites only. And I realized my country was fake and religion was fake, and that people could live in a country that allowed those signs and not tear them down. And so that's when I first flipped out, because I couldn't believe how horrible it all was. And so I had my three hospitalizations in 1 year at 17.
At the age of 17.
Then,
yeah, that's pretty amazing. You were ahead of yourself in a lot of ways, ahead of other people.
And then I was present at 18 in Washington for Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And I realized to myself, stupid, you don't kill yourself, you make revolution. And that's when I found out Mother gave me self-esteem. I didn't have to develop into revolution. I just had to decide what it was going to be. And the first decision I made was to be an instrument for peace and justice and care at all times. So I decided to never have another bad day. So I'm over 55 years without a bad day because I chose to live six qualities: happy, funny, loving, cooperative, creative, and thoughtful.
Now, you say in your book that after 10 or 12 days in the hospital, you told your mother, I'm all right now, and she believed you. She'd never acknowledged that you needed to be in a mental hospital in the first place. And your mother told you, you're not crazy. And she was right in the sense that I was a soul in pain, not insane. And you say your psychiatrist thought you should stay longer, but you wanted to leave and you signed out against medical advice. And you've been going against what other people thought for your whole life, pretty much, haven't you, Patch?
Well, it's not that I'm against what other people are thinking. I'm making, especially since I became 18, I realized that one option was for me to make me. So since I was 18, I'm exactly the person that I choose to be.
Let me remind listeners that my guest is Patch Adams. He is known for being a doctor, but also being a clown. And he has written a book that was a bestseller behind a movie, Gesundheit. And the movie was starred Robin Williams. Now, you say that the world of the arts helped you understand, because you were very talented as a scientist when you were growing up in the sciences. You were quite talented. You won competitions in science. And when I read this sentence, you said the world of the arts helped me with your understanding. And I think, gosh, in our school system now, when the budget gets tight, what do we cut? We cut the arts.
Well, let me say that I have really radically changed my thoughts about mental illness. I think the term mental illness is a pharmaceutical company diagnosis, that they're recommending these horrible drugs that affect your brain, and somehow that's their solution. I think mental illness actually comes from a loss of tribe, disconnect from nature, and unconnected to the arts. And that I've never given a psychiatric diagnosis or medication as a medical doctor.
Well, do you know what, too? We export this notion of mental illness so that we can sell our pharmaceuticals to other countries. We tell them, well, you know, you really need this drug. And that, too, is sad that we not only are doing it to ourselves, but we want to do it to other foreign countries.
I hated what it did to my imagination. My psychiatrist was an idiot. And it was just completely the wrong direction. But medicine in this country isn't a service, it's a business.
Patch Adams is my guest, and he's saying that you say you went 55 years without a bad day. It sounds like you were able to frame whatever happened to you in a positive light. How did you do that?
Even though in my youth I criticized thinking, I now, partly because I think of my partner Susan as the smartest person I've ever met, that thinking is how I make me. I decide who I'm going to be and how I'm going to respond to things. And I do that all the time. So I'm always there. And my library is 40,000 books. I know 4 hours of poetry by heart. I'm a nerd. And maybe have, who knows, I'm sure 500 or 600 books on nature and the arts. So these are the things that have made me who I am.
Well, you have I think part of that secret of 55 days without a bad day is that 55 years without a bad day is that you bring joy, because you notice that joylessness not only prevailed in the hospital wards you were in, but in your classrooms. You said many of your professors had a total lack of excitement about the field of medicine. And they didn't seem to like being lecturers, and they were not good at it. They had to lecture to keep their university positions, but their true interest was research. And you're saying that we should bring joy to our hospital wards.
Well, isn't it interesting? Loving's the most important thing in life, but not one public school K through 12 in the world teaches 1 hour of it. I haven't found a medical school in the world that teaches compassion. I mean, as one starts looking at the society, the idea that we give grades in school is criminal. No one ever should be graded, so that there's very little healthy in the way humans are living.
And yet, unfortunately, that's how we measure success, with grades, with numbers. And that's right. How you get into medical school. If you have
capitalism stole the word rich to mean money. Rich is a good friend, a tree you like to sit under. That's being rich, not money.
Well, I liked what you say in your when you were talking about doctors, and I've expanded this little test to include everybody I encounter. And here's what you said, that as you discovered a cancer in your profession, you begin wondering what it was doing to patients, so you ask them. And the patients, you said you heard anger, fear, despair flow out in a torrent of frustration. Rarely did I see their eyes sparkle for their doctors. And when I read that, I thought, well, yeah, I'm so fortunate. I have doctors that make my eyes sparkle. They have a sparkle in their own eyes. And I noticed that just generally about people. When they have a passion for what they do, their eyes sparkle.
Well, they certainly can. I mean, I don't know that they sparkle if what they want to do is violence or injustice. But I suspect that even there, that people can find the sparkle that they decide is their sparkle. I mean, I think my gender loves power over. You know, I tell my audiences, I think 85% of men are dangerous to women, and no man or woman has ever argued with me.
Yeah, and you just recently, just a few minutes ago, passed along a compliment to your wife. And I think you win over a lot of women when you do that, Patch. Let me remind people that my guest is Patch Adams. He is a medical doctor, also has spent his life as a clown and bringing joy to people. We're going to take a break, and when I come back, I will continue my conversation with medical doctor and clown Patch Adams. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, medical doctor Patch Adams, who incorporated laughter and creativity in his healing. His book is Gesundheit. The very first chapter in your book is entitled A Healthcare System in Pain. And your book is not that recent. This is some time ago, and I would have, well, 1998, wasn't it, Dr. Adams? Patch. That you wrote this book, the first chapter, A Healthcare System in Pain. And when I read what you wrote then, I can't unfortunately see that situation has improved.
No, it's gotten worse.
Yeah, and a doctor, a local neurosurgeon that has a sparkle in his eye, wrote a book too because he was suffering burnout. He comes home and his wife says, you know, you used to be a writer when you were in high school. Why don't you write this down? And so he wrote a book. His book is more recent than yours, but he has the same things to say that you say in your book. And you just said our healthcare system is in pain.
And I actually said it in 1967. Didn't write the book till later, but I could see there within a month of medical school, I saw that it was a male profession that didn't teach care or loving.
Well, you write in your first chapter that most healthcare professionals I have met tell me that burnout damages their personal as well as their professional lives. And that's what was this local neurosurgeon was saying, that he would come home discouraged and this burnout was affecting his personal life. And yet you write, I refuse to believe that burnout is inherent in medical practice. In fact, the practice of medicine can be a thrill, an exchange so fundamentally loving that it's difficult to contain the excitement. And we love hearing that from you.
That's been my 50 years in medicine.
Yeah. Yeah.
My first interview with an adult patient is 3 or 4 hours long. Since I don't care about making any money, I like that people are complicated. And so I usually know them better at the end of those 4 hours than anyone else in their life.
You know, my grandfather was a physician, and he didn't always get paid in money. Sometimes his patients couldn't afford, they didn't have the money. They would pay him with something they grew in their garden if they had nothing else to pay him with.
You heard me say I've never made a penny in medicine.
So then that raises the question. People say, well, Dr. Adams, how do you do this? How do you pay your bills if you don't charge your patients?
Well, the smartest thing I ever did in my life was to be communal. That's what I mean by tribal. I think nuclear family is a failed institution in every country. I've never found a country where the social workers and psychologists say more than 15% of the couples are happy. And it leaves a huge environmental footprint. And for 50 million years, we primates have been tribal. That's our natural state. I think mental illness is a lot caused by the fact that people are no longer tribal. And so by living together, those first 12 years when we had such an insane practice that each person had to come up with $35 to pay the rent. For 2 years during that time, I got a job as a file clerk because I wasn't going to make any money as a doctor. Never saw an insurance form. Don't want to.
Well, Patch, when people hear this, they say, well, he doesn't have deep pockets. If I want to sue him, what good is it going to do me? I can't sue him. And in fact, there's a sentence in your book saying to patients, please don't sue your healthcare professional. And you know what? It seems to me that because I have a friend who recently, the surgery was botched and he certainly had a case for a malpractice suit, but he wasn't going to do that. And what he said was, I think is typical. What he really wanted was an apology from the doctor. He didn't want to sue. He didn't want money. He just wanted an apology. And from what you describe in your book, your relationship with your patients is such that they wouldn't want to sue you.
I've never been sued. I want my patients to be a deep personal friend.
And so they would know. They probably wouldn't have to ask you for an apology if something went wrong. They would know. They would have trust in you. Let me remind people that my guest is Patch Adams. He is a physician who has spent 49 years of his life as an activist, a social activist, and trying to change America's healthcare system.
Actually, I've been an activist since I was 8.
Yes, you were ahead of yourself in a lot of ways. I mentioned your talent as in science as a youngster, and then you decided to go to medical school, and your eyes were opened as to how medicine is taught and practiced. And one thing you say in your book is because of this scientific basis, intuition is inhibited. And I want a doctor who uses all his resources, including his intuition.
And how will they do that in 5.8 minutes?
Exactly. Exactly. But they are pressured to do that. There's somebody waiting outside the door, an assistant, making sure the doctor doesn't get behind with his patients because he's got to keep them moving. And how do we change that, Patch?
Well, I think the way that I chose to do it is to show an alternative. I sometimes wonder if more than 15% of our adult population ever thinks. What I mean by thinking, do they ever do it? The normal American that I found in doing four-hour interviews didn't like themselves, didn't like their marriage, and didn't like their job, and that wasn't why they were coming to the doctor. That's what they accepted as their life. And so we're living in a world, I mean, look at our world. Ball players who are nobody, they kick a ball, bounce a ball, and they're multimillionaires. And yet they're nothing. And a school teacher who's the most important person of the human community doesn't make a good salary anywhere. And that's what the human beings are doing. How is it that we don't tax the rich 95%?
We know one thing that is different about your view of medicine and the traditional health care is that you are looking at the quality of life of the person's entire life, whereas nowadays, and you say this in your book, and I think it's sadly true, that traditional healthcare, their goal is to conquer death. The doctor considers he's done his job, he's successful, if he keeps that patient alive no matter what. And you don't feel that way, that the practice of medicine, that shouldn't be the goal, just simply to conquer death.
No, I'm about fun death. I also, you know, and the book was written a really long time ago, that how I talk about things now can be with a lot more reflection and a lot more discussion, especially since I've lectured and performed in 82 countries. I do a letter writing, and I've written over 300,000 letters to 139 countries. So I think healthcare, for example, represents 8 domains: health and diseases of individuals, health and diseases of families, health and diseases of communities, health and diseases of the world, and I was only educated in diseases of individuals.
Now, you mentioned just now that you applied the adjective fun to death. You even say that, and I want to get back to that, but you say the waiting room should be a waiting room that's fun to wait in. So what do you suggest that doctors, how do they make their waiting room a place that's fun to wait in?
When our hospital is open, people will know that the whole 327 acres with 3 waterfalls and 4-acre lake and the big gardens and all of the things that are going on, that's where they, quote, wait. They don't really wait in a room. They relax and enjoy. And if they're a first-time patient, they may feel less able to wander around. But once they've been there, they'll know that they come there and they may have to wait a couple of hours to be seen. And so they know they'll come and work in the strawberries or have a volleyball game or walk up this mountain with so much beauty to it.
Well, you say that in the waiting room, regarding the waiting rooms, you said maybe it could become an arena for wellness education and healing group interactions. And you say that we should, the healthcare provider should offer solutions and even donate time to create a vibrant waiting room. And waiting rooms typically are pretty serious places, Patch.
Yeah, and you were saying avoid eye contact.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, I've had 25 years since what you're reading was written, so have expanded on a lot of the things that are in there.
Well, now,
so the whole 327 acres would be the waiting room.
Would you say then also not only a waiting room should be fun, but a little bit ago you said you described death, a fun death. How do you create a fun death, Patch?
Well, do you want one, or do you want a miserable, anxious-ridden, panic-stricken, desperate move?
That's an easy question to answer, Patch. We all want, we don't want that death you just described. We don't want that. We may not know what we want, but we know we don't want that. And I never thought about having a fun death. But we all have this idea of how we would like our exit from this world to be. And I think that's a good idea to let's create a fun death and let your family, your friends know that that's what you want.
And it'll be different for each person.
Yes.
I can remember some young man in the early 20s was dying, and he wanted five naked people in bed with him. How hard do you think that was? I just said, I need four more naked people.
Well,
hands went up.
Yeah, and you just said it should be individual. And when you get to know your patients, as you do, because you spend a lot of time with them, you get to know them as individuals, and you know that they want this fun death to be whatever they define as a fun death. You just mentioned one that, well, golly, that sounds like fun to some people. Maybe other people would say, gosh, I don't want five naked people in bed with me.
You know, we can be reading the Bible. Whatever they want. It can be quiet with their family holding hands. Panic is not a style that we would reinforce. Or desperation, or...
I think it's even possible that people feel they want to spare their family. So their family sits by the bedside hour after hour, day after day, and the family member goes out for coffee and the patient makes his exit. And I think it's that's a possibility too, because they don't want to hurt their family members. So that may be a way that some people say, well, this is how I want to go out. Or maybe it's not even conscious that they do that, but
A doctors never talk with their patients about it.
Oh, yeah. You say in your book...
That's part of my initial workup of anybody.
Well, people are going to wonder, Patch, if there's so much wrong with our healthcare system, where is the blame? Who is to blame for this... In a word.
I would claim that capitalism is behind the cause of almost all the problems. And money and power over. And we can say men. Almost all the problems of history were caused by men.
Well, here's what you say in your book, and our local neurosurgeon who wrote a book agrees with you in this regard. You say in your book, the bottom line is to control healthcare costs and the greed that drives them up. Who is to blame? Doctors are an easy target. But what about healthcare insurance companies, hospitals, drug manufacturers, pharmacists, politicians who do nothing to help, lawyers who sue for malpractice, patients who hire them, the rest of us who tolerate and thereby condone this wretched system? So there's enough blame to go around. And you say what is needed is a drastic rethinking of the problem. Rather than quick fixing the failing healthcare, we need to create solutions that will excite both patients and caregivers.
Sure.
You say we must, in a mutual, multidisciplinary effort, tear down what hurts us, and heal a profession of healers. We must take medicine out of the business sector and recognize that greed and selfishness have placed society and its healthcare system in great peril. Our citizens need to feel a sense of belonging and of community. An improved healthcare system could help to unite society by taking care of all its members. That is, I think you're creating this, kind of giving us homework, if that's the word I want to use, inspiring us to do what you just suggested.
And can I have a final statement?
Absolutely.
Whoever is listening, if they've liked what they've heard, please help me. I'm never going to give up, but it's really stupid that we're not built to show a hospital at 10% of the cost, and that is radiant with love and humor. So please, whether you go to our website, patchadams.org, and make a donation, or want to send a check to the address at our website, or join a Patreon account, that would be a modern way, so they www.patreon.com/therealpatchadams and help get this hospital built.
My guest has been physician and clown Patch Adams. The title of his best-selling book is Gesundheit, Bringing Good Health to You, the Medical System, and Society Through Physician Services, Complementary Therapies, Humor, and Joy. Thank you, Patch Adams.
Thank you, and thank all of you who liked what you heard and decided to join the team. Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank my first guest, Naomi Klein, who will be speaking in Harlan Adams Auditorium this Saturday. Her book is On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.